What's that?
I would
hope HMRC would know where I live.
Pretty sure I told you.
You want to do this?
Yeah. What happens if Deirdre comes out?
She's fine. It's like that kind of podcast.
We let it happen?
Yeah, we just let it happen.
Let mistakes happen?
Yeah.
So do I need to sit there?
You should probably sit close to the mic, yeah.
Okay.
Is that okay?
It's fine. I presume you're already recording.
Yeah.
It's so marin.
Thank you.
You're so marinated.
Hey, you steal from the best.
Yeah.
Do you want to know what the podcast is?
You told me.
What is it?
Talking to actors before they go on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
I've not heard of anyone doing it before.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
I don't think
there's room for two of them. And certainly if you...
Certainly there is
And
not.
I think, like, no offense to the actors, you know.
Go ahead.
But
go ahead.
There's real potential for you to be trumped. Like, if someone else decides to do it.
Yeah.
And they're really, like, connected.
Yeah.
As soon as someone's like, oh yeah, I've got this show, like, podcast of interviewing actors before... They go on stage. First up is Judi Dench. So you can kiss your podcast goodbye.
I'm done.
Yeah.
Stuffed.
Yeah. That's it. You know, the same way, like Alec Baldwin started like just a little chat show on radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's had like David Letterman and Lorne Michaels
and
like Tom York and all these people. And like these big people are like running podcasts for like years and they're interviewing people like me.
The thing is like, it is a unique kind of thing, because you wonder what actors do before they get ready.
Yeah.
Some actors don't do anything.
Yeah.
And some, like, they really have something to
get
do.
Get into the zone. Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of it's very still, some of it's very active.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a real, it's a sort
And then
of
you fun. Go in and disrupt that, and that's great.
I go in and fuck all that up.
Yeah.
But it's also it's a place that we never really get to see. Or hear anything about the dressing room just beforehand.
The book, The Half, was just so
intriguing.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
You know, see what happens. I mean, like, this thing's going to be, it's got to be organic. Just accept it for what it is, but it doesn't mean it's always going to be that way.
Yeah.
There's going to be ups and downs and backs and forths.
Let's listen to Rory Keenan.
This is it.
So you got your own dressing room.
Yeah, ensuite.
Do you have a bathroom as well? Ah, dope. So what is this then?
Yeah, so this is a kind of four-sided square. Well, they're pretty much all four-sided squares, you know.
Is that a dressing room across the way?
Yeah, they're all dressing rooms, right from the top. So the tradition is that on opening nights, closing nights, and if... in the event that a cover goes on for someone else, everyone comes to the window and bangs for each other. So you got, at any given time, there's three shows going on in the building, so you've got three different companies supporting each other. And it's an amazing spectacle, actually. It's really, I kind of didn't know what was going on the first time when I was here when it started happening. But
Did you know it was going
to
happen?
No, because one of the dressers was in the room and she just ran to the window when this was happening, and I was like, oh great, I get the crazy girl. And then I looked out to see all these faces and hands just banging on the windows, supporting each other. But it's you never get to interact with, even with people in your own company in dressing rooms, because you're obviously in separate rooms. But you can actually interact with people in your own dressing room here in a really kind of just really cool way, because it's you never feel kind of you're imposing on anyone else, but also you have that kind of sense of community, which is great.
Yeah. Do you ever give the finger to anybody? Like,
always.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Bare arses the whole lot.
Nice. So this is where you prep.
Yeah. Prep. if you have a dresser, it's always a very grand term, dresser, but.
I've heard about this. Like, you have your own person that looks after you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm becoming more and more at peace with that term and what these guys do, because
why is that? What do you mean at peace?
Well, it sounds initially like a luxury and something that,
like, a class thing.
Maybe, yeah, or a kind of something of a bygone era, an old traditionalist thing, which possibly isn't required anymore. You know, you see those great skits that Ian McKellen did with his dresser, and there's always some sort of an unsaid a homoerotic relationship between the two of them, and but that's not going on here,
right?
But so I've always had that kind of, I suppose, prejudice against what that is. So I've always felt comfortable just doing my own thing and stuff. But Ralph, who is my guy, who he's been here from the very beginning, or at least for over 30 years anyway, since they moved into this building from the old Vic.
Beginning of the National.
Yes, pretty much.
Holy shit.
And he's dressed them all, you know.
Yeah.
And he is exceptional at his job. And I mean, he's not in tonight because this is one night off, because he's downstairs looking at the 50th celebration. They gave him a ticket for that because obviously he's been here for so long.
Yeah.
But that door would have been open already.
For real?
That we just walked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he knows I like to leave it on the latch.
Yeah.
I don't. Normally, you have to carry your key down to the stage to open the door and do all that rubbish. But I just like to have the latch on because I'd probably forget the key anyway. So he would have opened that. The kettle would have been boiling. The towels would have been a certain way. When I come off stage, he's waiting here. He knows exactly what shoe I need to put on first and what way I like, if I want a cup of tea here or a bottle of water there. The whole shebang. And again, that sounds like a luxury thing, but the more I kind of got used to it, the more I realized that what he's actually doing is making everything off stage for an actor non-consequential
for everything
that happens on stage,
and
making the professional work off stage invisible, pretty much.
Yeah.
So all of your concerted effort goes onto what you're doing on stage. That's essentially what he's doing, and he does it brilliantly.
That's amazing. Can I just turn that down?
Of course, yeah. Sorry.
That's your fucking channel.
That's the Olivier, that's the little bit in the Cadison. So you can listen to whatever's going on.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What is Leola?
Leola. Who and what is Leola? Yeah. It is a play by Luigi Pirandello. Written, I think, 1916-ish,
mm-hmm.
about a guy who fathers children with many women in the village, but is tied down to none of them. Very much a free spirit, a cad. Pretty much the only breeder in the village, because most of the men have gone away either for war or just to seek a better life.
Yeah.
And he's stuck. Well, he's not stuck, but he's very happily ensconced with all these women in the village, who some of whom hate him, and some, but most of whom think he has a pure and honest heart, which he does, and that's how he kind of gets away with it. So it's kind of Pirandello. Someone described it as Pirandello on holidays, because normally he deals with weighty issues like illusion and reality and all that stuff.
But
this is something completely far removed from what he normally writes. And
you've been enjoying it?
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah.
Company's been really good.
And who do you play in the play?
I'm playing Leola.
Nice.
Yeah, lots of research involved. sorry, I'm trying to open this.
Your sachet of soy sauce.
Wrong. Yeah. But
if your man was here,
he'd probably, yeah. I mean, he'd open his pocket and be dripping with soy sauce. He'd be, sir, of course. So I'll dip it in my pocket. I don't want to dip it in your pocket.
So you've been enjoying it?
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah.
We've been off more than we've been on, if you know what I mean, over the course of the run. Because The Light Princess, Tori Amos's musical, required a hell of a lot of tech time.
Yeah.
Very technical show. So we were off for over a month. Then we came back and we did a few shows, and then we were off for another few weeks, and then we came back, and so it's been crazy.
How was that, coming back to it after such a break?
Usually it's okay, but there's so many breaks in this that you kind of, you know, in rehearsals you're kind of breaking in a horse, and you get on the horse and the horse is doing really well, and it starts getting into a gallop, but then you have to get back off again and wait, and then break him in again, and then get. So it kind of feels like that. It kind of feels getting on and off a horse, sometimes at high speed, which isn't very healthy for the show. Because it's not a show that you can kind of ease into.
Yeah.
You got to hit the ground running because it's 90 minutes long, straight through. No questions asked. Don't think about it. Just do it. Mm. So you really have to kind of get in there at a speed. But you know, you can't complain getting all the time off. And
Olivier,
you know,
Olivier Theatre, technical work has completed on stage. Yeah. Technical work has completed on stage. Thank you.
The one thing about that tannoy, they you can't turn that down.
Right.
Which is, you know, I'm sure many actors over the years have been gazumped by missing their cues or whatever. So that's probably why.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you're sleeping here, you can that thing will wake up. But no, it's been great. Some people really enjoy having all that time off just to think about it and reappraise the show and all that stuff. But I kind of just feel if you're doing it, you're doing it.
Yeah.
And if you're tired, you're supposed to be tired. It's supposed to be hard work. So, but having said that, it does give you time to do other things in the meantime, which is lovely as well.
Like party.
Like party, yeah. Like sit in bed shivering, wondering why you went out again last night. What you're doing with your life and all that.
So what, this isn't your first gig here.
No.
You did something else
this
here.
This is my third one here, yeah.
Third one.
Mm.
What was your first?
The Kitchen.
That was your first?
Yeah.
That crazy,
yeah.
Arnold...
Wesker, yeah.
Yeah.
In the Olivier, yeah, that was mad. It was really good. It was, that was, when was that? 2000 and... Sorry for eating, by the way.
No, do your thing, man.
It was 2011, yeah. Yeah, that was really good. It seemed like they had no expense bearing on it. It was because we did.
You're like cooking on stage, right?
We cooked with no food, so we did all. But in order to be deft at that,
yeah,
we had to cook with food.
Right.
So if we're filleting a turbot, we need to know how to fillet. If we were fake filleting a turbot, we needed to know how to fillet a turbot so we could fake it or whatever.
Yeah.
So. So we did a week-long, I think it was a week, workshop where a very flamboyant chef called Jeremy Lee, who you might have seen on the telly, taught us knife skills and various other essential kitchen skills and stuff. But he would lean over to the assistant director and say, we need 25 more turbot, please, for the guides because I'm running out of turbot. A turbot's an expensive fish.
Yeah.
And we were going, we can just use haddock or something, you know. No, it has to be turbot. It needs to be. And so this guy would go out and he'd go, where am I going to source turbot? My guy, right, Jeremy has a kitchen, or had a kitchen up down by the South Bank. Ring my guy, he'll give us some turbot. And he was charging like 40 quid on his menu for this stuff.
Yeah.
And he was bringing them in, showing us how to skin them, fillet them, and then throwing them in the bin.
Oh.
And it was like, next, do that. And we had 40 sackfuls of onions. We had, like, you name it, whatever you wanted, you got. And that was my first. Normally, everything in theatre comes at a price, obviously. And most of the time, you can't afford to pay that price. So you're always having to skimp on one thing or another. But it just seemed with this that if they wanted it, they got it.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that I kind of I experienced that in theatre, because you just don't get that.
Yeah.
And that's when I kind of realised, okay, this place is different. This place is an exception to the rule. And maybe it should be, because it is the National Theatre. Maybe it should be a place where actually you can push the boundaries and the parameters out just a wee bit wider than you would normally anywhere else. And it was a great experience, and the Olivier was, it's hard to play.
Mm.
It's hard to play because it's just a problematic space, you know, and you really need a really bespoke show for that space, I think. And I think it worked in there. I did it. My second one didn't.
What was the second one?
Damned by Despair.
Yeah.
Who would have thought, with a name like Damned by Despair, which was programmed at Christmas.
Hey kids!
Hello, kids! Here's a devil to tell you about your doomed soul. Oh, God, yeah.
What was that like?
That was awful.
Really?
It was terrible, yeah. It was just hard. It was hard work. Yeah. It was a, I don't know, 14th or 15th century play.
Oy.
That no one had ever heard of for a reason, which got a reworking from Frank McGuinness, who is brilliant, and I love Frank, but very difficult writer.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't mean to be difficult. I mean, he's an incredibly astute and clever writer, but with the classics, he pulls no punches, and he will make it as complicated and convoluted for you as possible.
Yeah.
Because I think he believes that plays should be puzzles in a way.
Oh, right.
So it was just hard. So with those two elements together, plus just the nature of what the play was dealing with, which was heaven and hell and everything in between, it was very difficult to get on board with from day one.
Yeah.
I think we all kind of knew that the show was going one way and not coming back.
Right.
I don't regret doing it. People have asked me, have I regret doing that before? I don't at all. And I wish it could have been better, but I don't think you can regret doing a piece of work, because it's only ever going to be what it becomes, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. Yeah. So there were two very contrasting different experiences in the Olivier.
Yeah. So and that was in the Olivier as well.
It was in the Olivier as well. Yeah. Which was like, I mean, and the crowds weren't turning up, and rightly so. and if they were, they were only turning up for half of it a lot of the time. And it just felt like doing an obscure Beckett piece in the Boeing hangar in Seattle. Just this massive space where you can hear your own echo, and you just felt like the most minute entity in the universe, and no one's coming to get you. You're there all on your own.
Fuck, man.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough.
So let's go all the way back. How did you get into acting?
Because
your parents aren't actors, are they?
No. I started...
Somebody told me that you started young.
Yes, I did. Yeah, yeah.
How old were you?
I must have been around 10 or 11 when I did my first kind of show, like...
Was that like just at school or something?
No, that was in Dublin. That was in the Olympia Theatre. That was Sound and Music.
Oh, right.
So I started doing those, you know, musicals and stuff as a kid. And then I...
How did that happen?
That was...
Did you just go...
I think what happened...
Precocious little fucking 12-year-old. Today I'm going to be a song and dance man.
Yeah. I'm bored with this football. Who is this Brecht? I was, as we all were in school, you know, cheeky little bugger and you know, doing impersonations of the teachers and all that carry on. And I think my parents were told, okay, let's try and channel that energy somewhere else, so it's not, you know, acting the whatever in class. And so I went to speech and drama, and my two sisters followed suit as well. And they were actually... my mother was bringing them to an open audition for this show, for The Sound of Music, and I was stuck in the car reading Soccer Stars or something, going, oh, I'm bored. So Mum was like, come on inside, and Mum sitting waiting for me, and she was like, well, you might as well go in and have a go. So I went in, and they cast me. I got the part of Kurt Von Trapp.
Get out of town.
Yeah.
Did your sisters get cast?
No.
Get the fuck out. No resentment there.
No, yeah. So that was it. So from then I did another few shows with that director, and then I went on. I was doing stuff. I mean, at the third one was with Cyril Cusack, and then I went on and worked with Spike Milligan doing radio stuff and just great stuff. That's
all in Ireland.
Yeah. And then I joined the Abbey Company, the National Theatre in Ireland, when I was 14 or 15. Which was actually my first Pirandello play, which was Six Characters in Search of an Author.
Get out.
Yeah, that John Crowley directed. I was still in school during all that.
So you joined the company as like a company.
Well, they say that, but there's the famous Abbey players, but you know, I was just in the shows.
Right.
And then I did another one, I think the next year in there as well, and then a few years later. But meanwhile, I was in school and never really enamored by becoming an actor.
Yeah,
I did, because it was just something it was the extracurricular activity I did.
Yeah.
But never kind of made a conscious, concerted decision that this was what I was going to do. Even up to college, I wasn't entirely sure, even though it was what I was doing.
Yeah.
And maybe I didn't need to decide because I had already been doing it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Kind of maybe a subconscious thing, but
it wasn't like a big, like, sort of like,
exactly, it wasn't a leap. Yeah. It wasn't, this is what I must become. I think I was probably already becoming it, you know.
Yeah. So did you train? Did you go and train?
No, I didn't know.
Because you probably didn't have to, right? Because you're almost like, when you start at 15 with the Abbey, it's like an apprenticeship.
Yeah, well, I suppose they say experience is the best training and all that stuff. But I didn't want to train. I'm not by any way suggesting I didn't need to, or there was nothing that I couldn't learn. But I just wasn't interested in the process of actor training. But what I did do was go to... studied at Trinity College. I did a degree on the academic side of theatre, which kind of suited me because I was doing the practical stuff anyway outside of college. And I kind of thought, well, if this is something I'm interested in or good at, even maybe I should look at it from a different angle and get a kind of schooling in a more academic end of things. Which was good, you know. I think the two that they married quite well.
Yeah,
those two, and I got to do cinema studies and all that business as well. So.
Nice.
Yeah. So it was, and cinema studies was great because the book on film is only 100 years old, really.
And there's only
so much waffle in theoretical film studies. You can, however, in theatre, because it's hundreds and hundreds of years old. Oh my God, you're just wading through Dr. Farty Pants. From wherever, talking about another man's paper of another man's paper, and it's just kind of it's
dense.
Done drudgery, yeah.
Yeah.
But film
yeah.
theory is great because there is only 100 years of examples.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That was cool.
And it's a little bit more sort of accessible, isn't it? Because we, you know, we're so brought up on cinema and stuff.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. It's much more easy to absorb.
Yeah. Mm. And so, when did you make the move to London? And what kind of decision was that?
Well, I came over here with a show.
Right.
Did I? Yes. I came over here to do a show. Actually, no. I'd come over and back a few times before. I'd flirted with living here, and then I'd go back home, and maybe I'd come over. Oh, yeah. I came over to do a show with Rich Hall, the comedian. And we did that in London for a bit, and then we went to Edinburgh. And did I stay in London after that? I think I did for a while. And then I went back to work in Ireland. And then I'd come over and I'd do bits. I did a bit in the Dunmar. Then I came back. So then I kind of got sick of going back and forth. And it was in 2010.
Yeah.
I moved over to do... Yes, I was doing Max... Max Stafford Clark's
The Big Fella. Was that when it was?
Yeah.
Sort of decided to move over.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Which was nice because there wasn't a case where you know, like, here I am off the boat. What bar can I get a job in that they do speak good English in? You know, there was none of that. It was coming over on the back of a show and riding the wave for a while.
Yeah.
And it's been great ever since, I have to say. And my two sisters do live here as well, which made it easier. And I did have a network of friends over here anyway.
So they were here before you?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They studied here. Well, Sinead, my elder sister, lived here for a while, and Grania studied over here.
Yeah.
So,
And was that... So you didn't run into... Maybe you did. The whole... Because obviously you're doing really well and stuff. Hopefully that keeps going. We all hope that keeps going, right?
Yeah.
But, like, a lot of Irish actors come over... After being, you know, Mr. Hot Pants over in Dublin and stuff, and they get here, and suddenly it's just like...
It's a different kind of fish, yeah, I know.
Nothing.
Yeah.
But that wasn't your experience.
No, very luckily not. No.
Yeah. What is that about, though? How come that happened?
I don't know. I think... But in terms of, do you mean specifically Irish people?
Yeah.
I don't know. People say that there, that the theatre, speaking specifically about theatre, people say that theatre in London goes through periods of being in love with the Irish, mm. being in love with Irish authors
mm.
and actors, and lauding them for a while, and then it coming, falling out of fashion, but then coming back into fashion. And there was a time last year that we were doing Philadelphia, Here I Come in the Danmar. Then they were doing another Friel in the Danmar. Then they did two McPhersons mm. in the Danmar. They did another McPherson in the Trafalgar Studios. They had just done a McDonough in the Young Vic. They had just done something else in the Old Vic. And there was another show somewhere else. And it was at that summer and coming into the winter that there were something like 8 shows at the same time, yeah. 8 different companies populated with Paddy's.
Yeah.
And people used to say, my God, it's like being back in the late 1990s when McPherson and McDonough were all huge stars over here and
yeah.
everyone wanted their next hot thing. And so maybe it's a secular thing. Maybe there are times where people do fall in love with the idea of Irish artists over here, and you can tell, you can easily, you know, you can't, they can be forgiven for falling out of love with them as well. But I don't know if it is even specifically an Irish thing. I think it's just there's just the industry is so saturated over here
mm.
at all times that it's just a stroke of good fortune if you manage to avoid being ignored.
Mm.
And I've been very lucky thus far, you know, if you're working regularly and getting good roles and all that stuff, whereas many haven't. And it's nothing to do with quality or frame of mind or any of that stuff. I think it's just sometimes when you're in it, term you want to use, if you're yeah, it's like trying to quantify luck. You can't really do it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I'm struggling for words because I don't know.
It's such an ephemeral thing, isn't it? Crazy.
Bribing helps.
And so what was it, so on this play you were directed by Richard Eyre,
yeah,
who's a bit of a fucking legend, isn't he?
Yeah, he's great.
In this country.
Mm.
Like, he ran this place, right?
Mm.
I have his book, Changing Stages. I don't know if you ever got a hold of that.
No.
There's a book, and then they did a PBS series.
Oh, really?
Based on it, like a documentary.
All right.
And that was one of the reasons why I came over.
Really?
Was like that, yeah.
And was that his first one that he wrote? Because he's written a few.
Yeah, he did one. It was a diary or
National
journal.
National Service, yeah,
yeah.
The journal, yeah, when he was here.
Which is great.
Yeah.
But what was that like? I mean, you must have been somewhat familiar with him.
Yeah, definitely. He was brilliant because the way he works, it's very hard, it's kind of hard to define, which is a good thing, because it happens organically. Whatever it is, it happens organically. And he's very laissez-faire about the whole thing.
Mm.
Which means, I think, that he very much operates an actor-driven room. Great for us. Because I suppose when you think about it, directors are a fairly new phenomenon in 20th century theatre. You
sure.
know,
yeah.
You forget that directors, most of the time they were just actors who were pointing at furniture and saying, well, that should go there and not there, or
yeah.
why did you turn up late last night and pissed? because Olivier was the one who ran this place, and they're all actor managers, you
yeah.
know, and then this idea, this very European idea that directors had a voice on top of the show, that's a very new thing. So, but he, I think, very much of the traditional method in that it comes from the actors first,
wow.
and then he kind of steered it from then on. But brilliantly incisive, and
mm-hmm.
completely as in love with theatre as he ever was. And you can see it in his eyes. The man is over 70 years old now, I think. And he still bounds into the rehearsal room like a 19-year-old,
mm-hmm.
you know, full of beans. He loves actors, and he loves everybody involved in the theatre. And there's something really interesting that he says about this place, is that when he first took the job as director of the National, there was, you know, many people giving him advice and this, that, and the other, and he kind of said that what he slowly found out over time was that what he had to do was celebrate other people's achievements, celebrate other people's success, which is very unnatural for a director to do, because directors don't collaborate with other directors. They only work with themselves and a group of actors. But as a director who running a building, he has to work with other directors, and there's no point in being jealous or spiteful or withholding any kind of withholding any compliments or good vibes for them, because that's counterproductive to what the building should be doing. And you really see that in him, that he loves when you succeed.
Mm.
That's what he wants to do. That's what he wants to bring you. He wants to bring you your success.
Yeah.
So that he can enjoy with you, kind of a thing. Which is really great to see, because you can imagine how a man of that age working in the theatre for that long could, over time, you know, his shoulders could become a little more rounded and he could kind of plough the earth a wee bit more, but he's just a young man who still loves it.
Yeah.
And it was really great to see. And, you know, infinitely knowledgeable about the art.
Yeah,
you know,
gotcha,
just
yeah.
really, really brilliant. And so, yeah, I loved working with him. Absolutely loved working with him. It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so what sort of, do you, like, we were joking before about your prep. Do you do any?
My prep,
like, what's your thing?
My
prep
a manger.
Do you have a thing?
No.
You just kind of crack on with it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like a jazz player.
I sit here and drink, get pissed on whiskey and smoke.
Because some guys, they need to chill out. But it seems like actors nowadays, because Seth Numrick, who's in Sweet Bird of Youth,
right.
He was the same way. He was,
yeah.
I mean, he would have to go out to do this, like, at the end, that god-awfulness, right?
Yeah.
And, like, he kind of disappears for a second.
Yeah.
He's gone for maybe, like, 10 minutes or something like that. And then he reappears.
Yeah.
And in that 10 minutes, the shit that he would get up to, because we would have to go look for him. And we'd go into the wings for just like 5 seconds. We go, and he would always have a surprise for us. He'd be dressed in a costume. He'd be doing like God knows what. And like, it was always hilarious.
Yeah.
We were always like pissing ourselves trying to knock corpse when we go back on stage.
Yeah.
But me and my buddy John, we were just like, how the fuck does he do it? Because he's about to go back out and just bare his soul in a second.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's why I've been noticing about actors nowadays, is that it's just almost like, Maybe it's just the experience.
Maybe it's just sort of. I don't know. Well, first of all, I mean, I never trained, so I'm not very much aware of technique. I mean, I know about technique, but in terms of me practicing it, I don't have a history of practicing technique. So what you don't know won't kill you, type thing.
Yeah.
So that's one way of looking at it. But also, I do find that some people kind of say, you know, you should warm up in this way, your voice should do this, and I kind of think, how can you impose something so uniform upon a process that requires such an individual voice,
such a personal thing?
I don't understand how people insist upon that.
Mm.
I think that's completely reductive to what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And also, in life, you don't work yourself up into a tizzy to go and meet someone or to do something. You don't do that. You don't work yourself up into. You don't make sure your body is completely limber, your voice is. So why would you do it out there?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you do it when you walk onto a stage? Because you're still interacting with life. It's the only difference on stage is that we know what the future is, because we've rehearsed it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You're still talking to people. You're still interacting with other human beings. So I don't kind of see. Having said that, I've no problem with people, you know. I'm not anti it. It just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
It unnerves me.
Yeah.
To get into that kind of state of mind.
It's another form of fanaticism, isn't it, when you have this kind of method? It's almost like, are you substituting it for something else?
Possibly, yeah. You know? But, I mean, I do admire people who stick with it and who can stick with it rigidly and who are... They display a lot of patience, if anything, which is an admirable trait in someone. And I've absolutely no problem. It's, you know, when your method starts interacting or poorly with what I'm doing, that's a problem. That is a problem, and I've had that before. Where you're kind of going, hang on a second, we are on two completely different planets here. This is not good for the peace. And unfortunately, that's when it can get away from you. But no, I don't have a problem with it at all. It just doesn't work for me, and I think what works for you is what's best for you. You know, that's pretty much my thoughts on
that malarkey.
Yeah.
Nice. So what's next? Do you have anything lined up next?
Well, I'm doing. There's a couple of things in the pipeline, but in the immediate future, I'm doing the Theatre Uncut. Plays. I don't know if you know about them in the Young Vic.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where they get, it's really good. For a month, three writers or four, I think, but two of whom are Neil LeBoot and Tim Price, I think is one. They get they commission these writers to write politically engaging pieces. And anyone can perform them rights free for the month of November around the world. And we do this around the world. They do it around the world. They're online, these plays. And they, this year, I think the theme is, do we get more right wing in economically difficult times or something?
Yeah.
So Neil LeBoot has written this brilliant 10-minute piece called Pick One. I won't tell you what it's about. It's just three guys talking, and as the conversation, as Neil LeBoot does,
is a twist.
It gets crazy, so I'm doing that in the end of the month, in November.
Brilliant.
And then after that, we'll see. I'm kind of waiting on bits and bobs.
Yeah,
as we all are.
TV, film. You don't want to say.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, whatever.
Whatever's paying.
Yeah.
When is this run till?
Wednesday.
Till Wednesday.
This Wednesday we're done.
Last hurrah.
Yeah.
Good run overall?
It's been great.
One of the things, the annoying things that I saw out of you, probably don't, you don't read reviews.
Not really, no.
Some fucking idiot was like, I don't know why they had to have Irish accents. Like, why I had to be Ireland.
All right, yeah.
It was kind of like, what? What would it be? Like English accents?
I know, that's the thing.
As if that would translate better?
Exactly, yeah. I mean,
can't you see that a lot of like the rural sort of life of Italy is very similar to rural life of Irish people.
And if anyone invests as much colour and music into language as the Italians, it's the Irish. So it does make sense that it's in Irish. I know, yeah. People, but that's fine. People have objections about that, and I think most people are on board with it.
Yeah.
I think so. Because it does make sense. I mean, it just, as you said, it makes sense for, you know, early 20th century in Sicily, they were dealing with barren land, practically no economy, very tight-knit communities, had to rely on each other. Men were going away because of no jobs, no money. They needed strong women to stay behind, to work the land. And it's exactly what was happening in the west of Ireland and still is happening in the west of Ireland.
Yeah.
So it makes absolute sense. It's not happening in Gloucester. You know, so that's, and it just, the two wouldn't kind of mix, I don't think.
Yeah, well, right on. I think we got it.
Okay,
you think we got it?
Yeah. Get your pants off.
Fantastic. That was Rory Keenan, folks. Hope you enjoyed.
That was it. That was Rory.
That was it.
Mr. Keenan.
Mm-hmm. Charming.
He's a sexy voice, doesn't he?
Oh, doesn't he just...
It kind of makes you, like, hate him and want to marry him.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Often those two things go hand in hand.
A lot of people do that, actually. Yeah. A lot of people hate the people they marry.
Did you think it was insightful, some of the things he said?
Very insightful. I think I love his turn of phrase. And I'm glad this is the first one. Because there's no ego, you know?
Yeah.
There might be ego in other ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Not casting aspersions, but
no.
Actors are renowned.
We have been known to have a bit egotistical.
I've often been accused of having one, but
no.
Don't see it myself. But no, he's I loved a lot of his points. The inevitability of the path of like a piece was also especially interesting, especially because like imagine like directors, if a director leaves behind a project and thinks it could have gone better, or whatever, like they'll be. They can very much go through what they did and how they approached it and the decisions they made a lot more and say, and they could have changed it. You know, they could have decided not to, you know, because it's the director's choice if you're going to set it, you know, if you're going to set a Shakespeare in 1950s Cuba, then that's kind of the director's choice. And if that decision affects everything, you know, every single element of the piece. Whereas an actor is kind of like, you know, the director is the god that's kind of creating the river and putting the rocks there and deciding how fast the water's running, and whether it's white water or calm or whatever. And the actor's just given a boat and has to get in.
It's
just about how well they paddle the waters.
So the
thing about the inevitability of it is interesting, and it's through that he has no regrets about doing something. But it's a good one. You should try and get tickets to the show of like that night of every interview you do. So
yeah.
You can see the show.
Yeah, yeah. I know that's difficult though.
Try and get some freebies with this.
I know. Yeah, I got to try to capitalize on
why
everything.
Else would you do it?
Exactly. Absolutely.
You're in this for you.
Always, always, always about number one. So thanks for listening. Make sure to like the Facebook page, Dressing Room Confidential, and you can follow me on Twitter at Sean McConaughey. If you need to figure out how to spell it, I'll just give you a hint. It's not like Matthew McConaughey. So take that, world. Do you want to say bye, Dave?
Bye, Dave.
Do you want people to follow you on Twitter?
No.
Okay.